Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Emily, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $300,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is When Less is More in Healthcare. And now I'd like to introduce Dr. Sarah Woolsey, Medical Director at Health Insight.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for being here. My name again is Sarah Woolsey. I'm Medical Director with Health Insight, and we're thrilled to have all of you here today. We want to particularly thank the Hinckley Institute for hosting our forum. Guests who've traveled, you'll meet in a minute. We'd like to formally thank the ABIM Foundation and the Choosing Wisely National Campaign for their amazing support so that you could talk and have these conversations. And then we'd also like to thank, we have a local Utah advisory board for Choosing Wisely, and just want to thank all of those folks, and you know who you are out there, for supporting all the spread of information about the Choosing Wisely campaign, so thank you. I wanted to get a sense of who's in the audience. So welcome to all of you. Thank you for being here. How many of you are working in the healthcare industry, either as a provider or in the industry? Okay. How many people work in advocacy or in policy in that area, given we're at the Hinckley Institute of Politics? Okay, Dr. Hefner, great. How many of you are students of the university or someplace else? Okay, excellent. I am also a student currently at the University of Utah. And how many of you are from another group? Did we miss a lot? Okay. And then how many of you are patients or consumers of healthcare? Everybody get your arm moving. You kind of loosen it up. Okay. Yeah, so today we're actually in different capacities in this conversation, but all of us are at some point consumers of healthcare or have been consumers of healthcare. Just a couple of housekeeping items. First, you have paper and pen on your chair. One is a survey. When you're finished, please give us comments on how this went and how we can make it better. We're always interested in improving our events at Health Insight. Number two is I need to mention the exits for safety. The green exit, you can go out the back or the front. Women's bathrooms are down the hall on the right. Men's are a little bit of an excursion. You go down the hall left and left. So plan ahead if you're going to the men's room. And then finally, what I just mentioned today is a dialogue. We have two ways that you can ask questions of our panelists. One is the microphone in the middle. Please feel free to get up and ask your question. The other is you can write a legible question on the white card, hold it up, and we'll have someone pick it up and get it to Jennifer, our moderator. Any questions? Okay, I'll now introduce Jennifer Napier Pierce. She's a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. She also hosts, I want to make sure and say it right, Behind the Headlines with Jennifer Napier Pierce, which is a podcast on KCPW Radio. She's been around our community hosting great conversations, and we're honored for her to be our moderator today. So thank you, Jennifer.
Very happy to be here with all of you, and I'm hoping for a very candid conversation about the costs and benefits that we are seeing in healthcare. Thanks to technology and to research, patients have more healthcare options than ever before. There's a range of medicines and diagnostic scans and procedures available, and I would say that because we have this menu of options, patients and doctors have embraced them in recent years. But because there are so many, and because we are seeing costs spiral out of control, a lot of people are asking the question, are the treatments, the scans, the procedures really necessary to improve a patient's health, and are they worth the cost? And that's what we're talking about today. Just a statistic to throw out there, according to a report from the Institute of Medicine, up to 30% of healthcare spending is duplicative or unnecessary. And as a result, some doctors and healthcare providers and some consumer advocates, again, are pushing for this conversation, the kind that we're having today. So I'm glad that you're here. I hope you're engaged and start thinking about some great questions. We're going to talk about this effort called the Choosing Wisely campaign, and our panel of experts, let me introduce them briefly, Dr. John Santa on the end, right here, Health Rating Center Director for Consumer Reports. Next to him, Alan Ormsby, State Director of AARP Utah. In the middle, Dr. Wayne Cannon, he's Medical Director of the Primary Care Clinical Program at Intermountain Healthcare. Next to him, Daniel Wolfson, Executive Vice President and COO of the ABIM Foundation, which is behind the Choosing Wisely campaign. And finally, on the far end, Dr. Michael McGill. He is Professor and Chairman of Family and Preventative Medicine here at the University of Utah. He's also Executive Medical Director at the University of Utah Health Plans. And you will have a chance to jump in and ask them some questions. Our format today will be I will get some questions out of the way to get the ball rolling. Please start thinking about your questions again. Please come to the microphone, and if you would, introduce yourself. This is being recorded for radio, so speak loudly and clearly. Keep yourself to one brief question so we can get as many in as possible. If you prefer not to go to the mic, write it down, and I'll ask the question for you. So let's start with some background. The Choosing Wisely campaign, what are the goals? Daniel, I suppose I'll start with you.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here, and thank you for Health Insight about being such a great partner with us, and I appreciate all the efforts that you are making in Utah, and the publicity for this event was just tremendous, and congratulations. The word is getting out. The campaign is about conversations between patients and physicians about unnecessary care, and having that dialogue, open and honest dialogue. It's about national physician leadership identifying five things from their specialty that they deem as being not necessary, where the risks don't exceed the benefits. And it's about partnership with patients. And John Santa will talk about the role of patients and consumers in this, but ABIM is partnered closely with Consumer Reports. And the campaign is about supporting that conversation, supporting physicians and how to have that conversation, and equipping the patients with information from Consumer Reports so that an informed conversation can go on between patients and physicians. And soon, I think, and you'll hear today, that places like Intermountain and other places are beginning to implement the recommendations. And there's conversations now amongst physicians and within practices about how they can implement the recommendations.
Okay, well, why do we need to go through this exercise of setting standards? Dr. Santa.
Sure. Well, we need to go through it and go through it now because for consumers, it's about both our lives and our fortunes. We have so much at risk now that's related to health. And as I listen to Daniel, I always say choosing wisely is the gift that keeps giving. And it keeps giving in part because ABIMF did something that we wish more health organizations would do. When it comes to choosing wisely, consumers were involved from the start and at the top. And that's unusual, actually, when real consumers are involved from the start and at the top.
And that's kind of sad that it's unusual.
It's sad, but it's true. And also, I think choosing wisely has met the other requirement, nothing about me without me. Transparency. Consumers need to know what's going on in the health system, and it's so wonderful that at last the country's doctors are acknowledging that a lot of what they're doing isn't very helpful, may in fact be wasteful, may be unsafe and wasteful. And that's the kind of honest conversation between doctors and patients that the doctor professionals should have been having for a long time. And those now
are,
we are.
Those are strong words, harmful and wasteful.
Mm-hmm.
You use those deliberately.
I do, and you know, I was impressed that one of the board members in an interview on one of your TV stations used the word waste. It's a strong word. We've used it, and it's meant to be strong. Because it's time that something be done about that 30% figure. We just can't. We can maybe afford health care in the country if we get it just right. I don't think we can afford it if we're wasting 30%.
Hmm. Alan, you represent a huge block of consumers. I mean, what's your buy-in into the Choosing Wisely campaign? Why are you here?
Yeah, so AARP represents 211,000 people over the age of 50 in the state of Utah, and nationwide we represent about 38 million people over the age of 50. And I think our interest in this really is to improve the overall healthcare system, because as John mentioned, if you've got 30% of the healthcare dollars being put into questionable healthcare practices, that means you've got 30% that is not being available to spend on good quality health care. And we know health care is just going to increase in cost. So the value, I think, in a Choosing Wisely campaign is to empower consumers so that they can have this dialogue with their doctor. And I think that's one of the things that I'm most excited about the Choosing Wisely campaign, is that it's doctor-driven and patient-driven, and that partnership is where good quality health care takes place.
I want to drill down and make this real for people. So we're hearing harmful, wasteful, and you don't normally correspond that with going to your doctor. So Dr. Cannon, can you give us an example of a test or a treatment that you think is overused or is one of those words, harmful or wasteful?
And my voice doesn't carry very well, so from the back row and you can't hear, raise your hand, would you? So I'd say one example that's been very popular is imaging in patients with low back pain. So pain's a terrible thing. You know, if you have pain, you would do anything to get rid of that pain. And but the treatments that are truly effective for patients with low back pain aren't influenced by what you see on an MRI scan. And still there's kind of a tradition and a social network out there that supports, you know, my back's hurting, I need to have an MRI. There's research that has shown if you take patients with equal symptoms, the ones who get the MRI are more likely to go on and have a procedure or some other thing done. And also those who have an MRI are more likely a year after to be more likely to be on disability. So absolutely there are patients with back pain who should have an MRI. But you can really determine by what the patient tells you and what you see what can best be done to help the patient. And there are very effective treatments for low back pain.
Dr. McGill, what about you? Test procedures that you think may be overused or used in the wrong way?
Well, I'm in primary care. I'm a family physician, and I teach family doctors. And we're very interested in building partnerships with our patients. When you have a family physician that you can go to, who knows you, who you trust, who you can communicate with, that increases your sense of confidence that you're going to get the care you need. What we want to make sure of is that you understand that together the physician and patient need to respond to the best evidence of what helps and what doesn't help. The concrete example that we encounter all the time in family medicine and primary care is a question of whether patients who have a cold, a cough, a bronchitis, a sinusitis, an ear infection, all those things that we all get all the time, in fact, I'm just getting over my own version of it right now, the question is whether to prescribe antibiotics. And I can't tell you how many times I've had people come to me and say, Doc, I got a cold, and last time I had a cold, I got penicillin, and it went away. And, of course, the truth is that if you get penicillin for a viral cold, upper respiratory infection, it'll go away in about 7 to 14 days. If you don't get penicillin, it'll go away in about a week or two. It doesn't help, and we know that. And we do know also that it causes harm. Some of the research that we've done here at the University of Utah has documented that the antibiotic use for viral upper respiratory infections changes the pattern of resistance that bacteria have. It causes bacteria to become resistant to antibiotics so that when you need them, you can't use them. So it's affirmatively harmful to take antibiotics unnecessarily for a cold, and it doesn't help. So there's an example.
Hmm. When we talk about this partnership, though, with the doctor and the patient, I think the patient is inherently vulnerable because we're going to the doctor because we don't know what's wrong. So, I mean, are you saying that doctors have a tendency to err on the side of caution? Or, I mean, what is going on here? What the dynamic is, there's sort of this patient who doesn't know, is seeking advice and help. You have a doctor who knows that maybe this is not going to really help, but does it anyway. I mean, is that what's going on here?
So everybody in that room, the doctor, if it's a child with a cold, the mother, the parents, everybody wants to do the right thing and help the suffering patient get better. The physician wants to do things that will be of help and wants to err on the side of things that may help that we may or may not know help. This Choosing Wisely campaign is a terrific way to help all of us together understand better that, for example, antibiotics for viral upper respiratory infections don't help, and that while we're together in our goal of helping the patient feel better, what we can talk about is those things that really are going to work. If we have sort of prepared the ground, if you will, with understanding that what seems like it should work is not going to. And so let's talk about the things that really can help.
Okay. So Daniel, we've heard about the MRI. We've heard about antibiotics, you know, when they are appropriate and when they're not. How do you sort of break down the thousands of tests and procedures that are not doing what they're supposed to do? How is this Choosing Wisely campaign sort of narrowing the field to those that are the most harmful and the most wasteful?
So I think what we've done, which I think is remarkable, is to ask the specialty societies, who really know best, because they've developed clinical guidelines, about what they think are the biggest areas of overuse and overtreatment. And I think that in itself has, and now we have over 60 specialty societies. Literally every physician in America is being touched by the Choosing Wisely campaign. And they begin
to... So the psychologists are getting together and the
back
doctors... That's
right. Psychiatrists are getting together, and soon non-physician groups will be getting together. And they're coming up and providing leadership in their organizations, and physicians listen to their specialty society. That's where they get their education and leadership. And I think what they're saying is more is not always better. And for the patients as well, more is not always better. Sometimes less is better. And I think physicians have been trained to be thorough. No rock unturned. And I think patients are equally, don't leave anything out. You know, and I think what is happening now is we just can't afford that. We can't afford to do things that are recognizable, non-value procedures and tests. We just can't afford that in our country anymore. And we are hurting people. We are harming people. And it's not just the test that begins. It's the cascade of events that occur after an initial test. A stress test leads to a catheterization. Catheterizations are, you know, usually negative through a stress test. And you've hurt somebody. A friend of mine was hurt by a catheterization. Very strong burn on their chest and a leg injury. Not necessary. And we are hurting people. Institute of Medicine calculates 30,000 people die of unnecessary tests and procedures each year. So we're wasting money and we're not providing the best care. And that's really the point. It's about the best care, providing the best care at the right time, the right place, to the right patient. And this campaign, I think, rings an appeal to physicians and patients because it's about better care. And better care is getting rid of what is wasteful.
Alan, what is the consumer's role in this? If patients are going to a doctor seeking advice, what role do they have to play in the exam room?
Yeah, I think empowerment is probably the key part of that. I'll give you an example from my own life. My son, and this was in the Tribune, so I apologize if anybody read this already. But
no, good. I'm glad you're reading there.
Oh, good. Reading and being quoted there, so I really like it. My son was had very severe abdominal pain, and it's bad enough that we decided to take him to the emergency room. And, you know, the doctor who was doing the examination did all of the right things and said, "Boy, you know, this really looks like just a bad bout of constipation. We ought to get an x-ray just to confirm that and then see where we're at." And so we did. And, you know, the whole thing probably took about an hour. And the x-rays came back, and sure enough, you could really see poor kid's got a bad bout of constipation. And then they said, "Well, just to rule things out, rule out appendicitis and rule out internal bleeding, we ought to do a CT scan." And I wasn't empowered enough at that point to say, what would happen if we didn't do a CT scan? What is the value in bringing that CT scan? And what would that cost be? Is it okay if we, could I take him home, give him the laxative, and 24 hours later then come back and check? Had I been more empowered, I think I would be able to say, let's do that rather than spend another 6 hours at the ER and another, $2,000 out of my pocket to get a CT scan and, just to rule out the odd chance that he might have appendicitis, even though he had no fever and the doctor said, there's really no chance that he has it, but let's be absolutely thorough.
So, but again, in that scenario, as a parent, you do feel like, well, I've got to go with the doctor's advice. So as a consumer advocate, you see a big part of this being on doctors, too.
Well, we do. We've done quite a few surveys and focus groups, and we know that consumer reports can say to consumers, well, you don't really need that image for your back, or you don't really need those antibiotics. And they'll kind of listen. And they trust us a lot, but when it comes to what not to do and not getting something, they overwhelmingly say, well, I'm going to ask my doctor, because they trust doctors. Very skeptical of drug companies, very skeptical of insurance companies, very skeptical of government, hospitals. They trust doctors. And they're going to turn to doctors. And, you know, it gets back to, I think, what ABIMF started this. It's all about professionalism. Professionals are supposed to kind of curb and moderate the excesses of the market. And we have a heated up healthcare market. You know, I chuckled when I thought the Tribune article was fantastic. Then there's 53 comments, incredible comments. Probably some people saying things that none of you will say, hopefully. But at the very end, here's an ad for testosterone. That's creating demand for testosterone. We actually have a topic, it's not going to be the focus here, in Choosing Wisely, about overuse of testosterone. So as we do this, there's a much better financed campaign going on that's causing overuse. So it's so important for doctors to step in and say, you can trust me. Here's the just right amount, and I'm here for you, and I know you're concerned. I'm going to be here tomorrow. That works.
Dr. McGill, I mean, in a time and place where if I get sick, I go to WebMD, and I start typing in my symptoms, and I've got a whole list of questions from my doctor, and I say, oh, well, there's this drug that can help me. Is that just part of modern medicine, you know, where you have to say, well, the studies are not quite there yet, or you can't trust everything you read on the internet? I mean, there's a line there, too, to a patient who's advocating for their own health and yet may not have full information that 8 years of training will give you.
Sure. We have sort of a cultural bias, and the cultural bias is that technology will fix everything. And so when we see something that might help one out of 100 people, and you're the one with the symptom, and you're suffering, you say, well, why am I not that one person? I want to give it a try. I want to give it a shot. Because we have confidence in the effectiveness of the new technology, the new treatment, the new test. Part of the benefit of having looked things up yourself is that you've actually thought through some of those questions. And I can't tell you how important and valuable it is to have a patient come and say, you know, I've looked this up and I see that there's this new treatment online, but put it in perspective for me. What's the chance it's going to really help me? What are the alternatives? What if I don't? What if I don't get that CT scan? Is that really going to lead to harm if I wait 12 hours and see if things go away? What's the chance it's going to go away? Well, in that case, chance is pretty high it's going to go away and you didn't need the test. But if you do need to be seen again, you're that one out of 100, I'm here for you. So it's that conversation that's so important. And I think the kind of questions that the Choosing Wisely campaign suggests that patients ask, they're not specific to imaging or to antibiotics or to a particular test. They are questions that every patient should be asking as they communicate with their physician. What's my diagnosis? What are the possible outcomes if I do something now, if I don't do something now? Will you be there if I'm that rare person that is not helped by just waiting, or if I'm that individual that has the rare condition that needs further treatment? Hmm. So that conversation is really terrific. Patients need to be prepared to share that conversation and not come in and say, ah, I read it on the internet, and I believe everything I read on the internet, and I heard that there's this magical cure, and I want it right now. That approach doesn't work very well. It's not the way to get the best care, but a balance is really appropriate.
Dr. Cannon, what percentage of your patients today are engaging in these types of conversations with you?
I can tell you a percentage, but it's a lot more than it used to be, which is wonderful. And about 10 years ago, there was a campaign locally about antibiotic use. And that was kind of a turning point. I had a partner once who had a father come in with a note from his wife that said, don't come home without an antibiotic. You know? And we don't see that. We see parents, and I'm a pediatrician, who are very interested in not giving their child an antibiotic if it's not a good thing or other things. So there's been a real shift. But I would say a lot of that's been on antibiotics. We could use the same thing in all of these Choosing Wisely areas. Physicians are very supportive of this. We've talked to about probably a couple of hundred in our trainings. And it's rare that anyone's upset, but their concern is, how do I really explain this to my patient when they come in with an expectation? They're going to be disappointed. They'll think I'm withholding care. They're going to think I'm worried about saving money. And how do we help them when there are good things on the web, but there are things on the web that are kind of misleading, too?
Mm. What about fear of litigation? How does that figure into this whole thing?
Well, you know, the nice thing about the Choosing Wisely recommendations is none of them recommend withholding any care that's ever been proven to be helpful. So they aren't recommending not doing things that are helpful to save money. It's things that aren't helpful or harmful. So it's still possible there's this rare thing that could pop up that maybe you could have missed if you did a total body scan on everyone that walked in the door, but I think it's unlikely that an attorney would pursue something when there's such good evidence that supports what the physician did.
We're about the midpoint of our conversation, so I'm going to let you join it as well. Again, our time is somewhat limited, so keep your comments to one brief question. Please identify yourself, your name, your affiliation, if that is pertinent. If you don't want to get up to the microphone, hand me a question.
Yes.
Do you have a question?
I do. I'm Corey Capoza. I'm actually co-chair of the Choosing Wisely Utah campaign. And my question is, how does this Choosing Wisely campaign and messaging fit into the larger discussion about healthcare reform in the country, which is sort of currently being implemented? How does this all tie together? Thank you. And if you have a question, please come up right behind me and proceed. Thank you.
Daniel, do you want to
jump in? Well, I think that a lot of healthcare reform has been about access to coverage. There's been some experimentation with organizations, accountable care organizations, and patient-centered medical homes, but it really didn't address the affordability issue. And I think that this initiative outside of government, outside of the payers, the patients and the physicians in the room has got a chance of doing something that's really unique, and that is professionalism in action, where physicians are taking the responsibility outside of anything else, just their professional obligation, to and take a responsibility for the affordability issue. Not the payers, not the government. This is an internal kind of strategy. It's kind of like give professionalism a chance. Give the patient and physicians a chance to work out the affordability issues without regulation, without intervention of the government. So I think that the Accountable Care Act, personally, and my organization doesn't take a stance, is wonderful, but it's about access. It's not about affordability. It didn't go that far in that realm. We need to get people insured first, and that was its major focus.
Dr. Cannon?
One little comment. I used to worry about the national debt, but the national debt's this big compared to the unfunded Medicare expense that our government faces, and it's a bubble that will burst someday. And so the answer is improving health and decreasing waste. And that's the best we can do, and that's what this is about.
Dr. Santa, are consumers asking their doctors, so how much is this going to cost me? Should they be?
Yeah. Well, they are, because more and more of them, even if they have coverage, are responsible for paying. My 35-year-old son finally got a job with benefits. He makes $30,000 a year. He has health insurance. A $750 deductible, but 40% copayment, up to a $6,835 out-of-pocket. So a $30,000 a year guy, and he has some health problems. You know, he's exposed to $6,800 a year. He now gets it. He's asking. I mean, he recently went to the pharmacy with a prescription and was stunned when it cost $300 for 30 days. Hmm. He doesn't have $300. We do, but he doesn't. So if you look at the percentages of consumers who are now in high deductibles or significant cost-sharing plans, it's going up and up and up. It's a reality for all of us.
And Dr. McGill, is that part of medical training now, is to have that conversation?
Yes.
This is a great treatment, but it's going to cost you $10,000.
So we know that historically physicians have had no clue what the cost of tests and procedures were. And so here at the University of Utah, the training for physicians is increasingly including discussion of what would that cost, what's that cost to your patient, what's that cost to the system. And I think it's important to realize that we have a huge crisis. Dan mentioned coverage, insurance coverage. We have insured people. We still have uninsured people. The Affordable Care Act is chipping away at that. But if we are spending 30% of our healthcare spending in the United States in a way that is not leading to value, it's not helpful, if we could improve the quality of care, the cost actually goes down, and frankly, there's more than enough money in the system already to cover everybody. And that's one of the kind of secrets of this, that better healthcare is less expensive and frees up money that you can then use to cover everybody who needs health insurance. Mm-hmm.
Okay, go to your question.
Hi,
your name?
I'm Jim Gudgeon. And experienced clinicians and lots of different types of health services researchers have known for decades that there are lots of services and interventions that are provided that are either ineffective or worse, harmful. So why is it that you think it's taken so long to actually start a campaign like this and explicitly acknowledge that there are all these things that have been done for a long time that aren't, that shouldn't have been done?
Is it research? What is it, Daniel?
I think it was an act of courage to have the physicians admit that there was waste in the system and taking the initiative to say we've got to stop. We have to stop doing things that don't make any sense. We know that there's things out there. We can't afford it. So they have a choice. They can have things done to them, or they can do it to themselves. And they chose to do it to themselves and take leadership and truly be professional. Take responsibility for managing resources. Most physicians, until this campaign, did not think that that was a part of their job description. And a place like the American Board of Internal Medicine, who thinks about competency of physicians, can say, yes, it is. It's stewardship. Stewardship of resources is a basic competency that physicians, when they graduate from residency of medical school, should have that competency. So that's a sea change. And I think it's a testimony to, I think, the changing nature of specialty societies that are looking to improve quality and affordability and look at high value. So why they didn't do it before, I can't tell you. But it's a new day, and thank God.
Yeah. And I agree, it has taken a great deal of courage.
Yeah.
Better now than never.
Yep.
Alan?
Some of the research that we've done in AARP has to do a lot with the attitudes of baby boomers versus the attitudes of the greatest generation. And, you know, the baby boomers are the classic question everything. And I do think that has a big component to why this sea change is taking place now. Well, those people, 65 to, you know, the youngest baby boomers are just turning 50 now. They're the prime consumers, and they're asking those hard questions. And they expect to have these dialogues rather than just it being kind of a one-way street.
I want to get to some of our written questions because there's some good ones here. How do I make a medical decision that my doctor leaves up to me? When a doctor gives options after a conversation, what is the next step? So I guess that goes back to a whole philosophical question, but also a very practical matter. You're confronted with five choices. Where does a patient go from there?
Premise of that question, the doctor leaves it up to me, is, in the way I hear it, sounds like an unbalanced conversation. I don't think that it's any more appropriate for the patient to have a menu of choices laid out for them and the doctor to say, oh, just pick one. It's no more appropriate to do that than it is for the patient to say to the doctor, oh, you just tell me what to do. The right place is somewhere in between. And so if you hear your physician saying, well, just you choose, you have the opportunity as an engaged, activated patient to say, great, I'd love to be a part of this decision-making. Help me understand the consequences of the different choices. You're the doctor. You've seen this a lot before. You're the one who's familiar with literature. Let's make this a conversation. So return it to that balance. And think through together, what are the consequences of different choices? What are the possible outcomes? What are the remediations if something goes wrong? and make it back into that two-way conversation. Don't accept the one-sided premise.
Anyone else want to chime in on that one? No? Okay. One more written, and then I will get to you. How can this campaign help influence daycares and elementary schools, which require 24 to 48 hours of antibiotics in order for children to return to class? No one wants to take this. Okay, yes.
Well, there's actually a variety of Choosing Wisely topics that we're now realizing are kind of institutional. For example, there's 12 topics around hospitals requiring preoperative tests, or anesthesiologists requiring preoperative tests. And actually, the anesthesiologists, God bless them, have just come out with five topics, and one of their top topics is, let's knock off all the required tests for low-risk people. And this is a good example of another set of organizations who they need to get it institutionally, and folks like you all need to get them to engage in conversations that hopefully will reverse these policies. Because, as was said earlier, they are harming their children, not helping them.
Dr. Cannon, have you faced this question? You're a pediatrician.
Well, certainly. So this is not really a Choosing Wisely topic, but it's an important topic. And there are some conditions where absolutely it's a good idea. For example, strep throat. You want to have a certain time on medicine before you go back. Certainly the people that didn't need an antibiotic can go right back, you know. But it's not a Choosing Wisely topic, but it's something that we struggle with as physicians, too. And I've written many notes to get kids back in school before the 48 hours.
That's a good question. Yes.
Hi, my name is Malin Cottom. I'm a student in health promotion and education. And sorry, I have to give a little lead up to my question here. I feel that I, and I'm assuming most people I know, grew up going to the doctor, like with a parent, have someone speak for us, relay information from the doctor to us. And I'm just now starting to like face the healthcare system going to the doctor by myself.
It sucks, huh?
It's intimidating, I'm not going to lie. So I'm wondering if you would agree that transition is important, and what either healthcare providers, the parents, or someone of like my position can do to have, you know, a lifelong habit of choosing wisely and not like wait till, you know, I have my own children to start to think about whether something is necessary or not. Thank you.
The younger generation. And this is actually a question that goes along with that. How do we have this conversation in the short 10 minutes allotted for each patient? So how do young people get this conversation started, and how do doctors actually squeeze it in to these really short appointment times that you have? Dr. Cannon?
So one of the things we've done as part of our Choosing Wisely is to develop materials to give to patients that can help them understand things. So not go read this and give me a call, but things that can kind of go beyond the discussion you may be able to have in that 10 minutes. I think it's important to take the 20 only if you have 10, if it's one of those circumstances. And, you know, it would be good to include advocacy. We as pediatricians, try to talk to our patients as much as the parents, and often the parents learn something very interesting when we're doing that. But I think it's just part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Daniel?
We've developed some communication modules for physicians. If it's done efficiently and effectively, and there's a skill set around how do you talk about unnecessary care, I don't think it takes 10 minutes. I think it, if you did it efficiently and you had some skill involved, and there is some skill involved, but physicians are taught about how to talk about their patients not doing something. They're usually talking in reverse. But there is a way of and a method, and I think it you know, it's part of our campaign to support the physicians in this conversation as well as the patients. And frankly, they don't have good skills, and they need to build better skills around this issue.
Alan?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't think it's I think that intimidation factor is not a function of age. Because I certainly still feel very intimidated, and you know, I'm in my 40s, and I've been dealing with doctors for a long time. I think it's having that dialogue in your head, knowing what to ask your doctor prior to going in,
when the doctor recommends something, you're not challenging them, you're not saying, well, you must be wrong or you're trying to milk money out of me, but you're asking legitimate questions. What would happen if I didn't do this? What are my alternatives? What are other options that might be available to me? What is this going to cost? Those, if you've got those questions programmed into your head, you're going to have a much, much better dialogue with your doctor.
Hmm. Yes.
Hi, so my name's Michelle Fogarty, and I am a 47-year-old single mom student with three kids that are 18, 14, and 11. So I've seen quite a few doctors. I've had four knee surgeries in the last couple of years, and two of them were performed by Dr. Grice over at the University Orthopedic Center. I've been begging for a replacement for a while, and because of my age, they try to stall it. And he finally gave me the okay a couple months ago. He's like, okay, you qualify. The inside of your knee is a centimeter shorter than, you know, medial than distal. So it's time, which was a big deal for him to finally admit that. So then he goes, you need to go see Dr. Gilliland. So I go see him. And I actually, because I have children, and one of them has autoimmune and asthma and everything, I do write down every single question exactly going into the meeting. So then I'm speaking with Gilliland, and just like you were talking about, the 10 minutes ran up. I had like four more questions, and this is regarding him replacing my knee in like 2 weeks.
He goes, me, our time is running out too. So do you have a question?
Yeah. So my question was, he left in the midst of a consultation on a knee replacement with half my questions answered because of the next patient, never called me back, nothing. Like, how do you teach doctors professionalism? Like, if your patient is provided and knows what they're talking about and educated in that industry, and they want to know the facts,
I can sense some frustration here.
Well, I have a three-week knee replacement.
It's shared among a lot of people who have gone through that. Contributions? What do you? Who would like to jump in?
Well, I would just echo what Dan said. And I can't obviously comment on the specifics of your experiences. That certainly sounds frustrating for you. And I can tell you that there are specific skills that. That we teach our physicians in our family medicine residency training program that do help them connect with patients and identify patients' needs and respond efficiently. I don't think we have to attribute any bad will anywhere here. The constraints that the way we have designed healthcare, the way we organize it, lead to some tensions in how people spend their time. And sometimes the tensions get out of balance and get in the way of good patient care, good communication. It is possible to learn the skill of efficient communication and tuning into the patient's concerns and needs. And we see it all the time, and we're also human, and sometimes we fail.
Mm. And I have another question on the insurance end. Three surgeries, I got told ahead of time how much it would cost. This time, Hoffman, and nobody would give me a price, including the insurance company. And then it ends up with the $6,000 out-of-pocket deductible, and the regular deductible. So why don't insurance companies now or the hospital itself tell you what something is going to cost when they did it a year ago?
Is the insurance company part of the Choose Wisely campaign, or is this strictly on doctors and patients at this point? Or?
At this point, it doesn't involve, but I think cost transparency is a real issue and something that we certainly advocate. It's not done very much. And if you ask a doctor in a hospital how much does that cost, they can't find out, literally, depending on the institution. Sometimes they can, sometimes they can't. But I think that this is an issue that's going to be increasingly intolerable not to know the cost. Mm. And so I think that's the next way. You know, we do physical harm. We also can do financial harm, as we talked about. And I think that's a major issue. So,
okay, Dr. Santa and then Dr. Cannon.
You know, cost is a second and as big or bigger than are you getting too much health care? I mean, Health Insight should take on cost at some point, and there should be meetings about that here.
Yeah.
If you're in Massachusetts today, by state law, you would, your doctor or hospital or insurance company would have 48 hours to tell you how much it's going to cost you. 48 hours.
So there's a policy component.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That would be awesome to get that in Utah. Because I also did not get the insurance company, which is Student Health, United Health, to give me an answer.
But it's different than choosing wisely.
Right.
So,
yeah. Right. That's a topic for another day, but thank you so much for the question. Here's one. Is there anything we can learn from other countries that deliver lower cost and higher quality care? Alan, you're nodding.
I certainly think so. I think, you know, in the United States, we're really fond of saying we have the best healthcare system in the world. And that may be true if you have access and if you have dollars. But objectively, we're not the best healthcare system in the world, and we do have a lot to learn from other countries. I appreciate what Dan was saying about the Affordable Care Act being a very positive thing in terms of access, but it hasn't done everything that needs to be done in terms of cost. And so we could learn a lot, I think, from other countries on the way they deal with the cost side of the equation and institute some of those in our own healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. Daniel?
Choosing wisely has gone international. Choosing wisely Canada opens next week. We have over 10 countries that we're working with about choosing wisely. So there is waste in those countries. Mm-hmm. I think they control their costs in different ways. But there is waste, and they're worried about their gross national product being lower. It is lower, but to increase it has major impacts on those countries. So they are very interested. And I'll tell you why they're most interested. It's because they believe that the profession can do a lot more and that it's always the voice of the government. Now it could be a voice of the physician. And I think that's very appealing. It's very appealing here. It's very appealing around the world.
Mm-hmm. So probably, except for genetics, your lifestyle is probably more important than your treatment. And a lot of other countries have better lifestyle. A lot about choosing wisely is lifestyle. If we could improve lifestyle habits in our country, we would look a lot more like other countries.
Yes, your name.
Hi, I'm Sharon Hamilton. I work with Intermountain Healthcare and work with Dr. Cannon. One of the things I wanted to actually stress is obviously I'm a proponent of choosing wisely. And as we've tried to actually roll this out in our healthcare organization, I think in answer to one of the last participants' discussions and maybe frustration is that with choosing wisely, too, we have to also have shared decision-making tools. And that's one of the things that choosing wisely is really just the first step in actually identifying what it is we need to look at and maybe not do or really question. And so we really need to have additional aids with our patients because our times with our providers are very limited. And additionally, it really takes a team. So we really have team-based care where we know the physician has 10 minutes or 20 minutes with a provider, but it's that care manager, social health worker that's in the clinic, ancillary support services. So it's really a team effort and then just not the one individual. So
do you have a question?
No, I was actually making a comment. So
okay.
I guess I wanted to make a comment that this is important, but it also is a team approach as opposed to just, you know, physicians saying what you should or shouldn't do, and the patient has responsibility with shared decision making.
Can I comment? Because I think that's a
Please.
Great point. And we're about to go a step in that direction. We're going to announce that the nurses, dentists, and PTs are going to enter this campaign. And that's the first step, because I think what ultimately we want is a interdisciplinary recommendation, not just from the physicians, but from the group. Critical care actually did it with the critical care nurses. And so we're going in that direction, and I think you're absolutely right. Why are we siloed in our recommendations? We should have to, team, interdisciplinary team recommendations rather than just physician. But I think it was the place to start.
This is somewhat related. What are your feelings about this idea of doctor on demand, where a patient consumer can access a doctor through the phone or email 24/7? Probably not a great lifestyle choice, but I mean, is technology empowering doctors in a different way and interacting with their patients in a different way? And does that fit into the Choose Wisely?
So we're getting beyond the Choosing Wisely campaign specifically, but I think it's really appropriate to recognize that Choosing Wisely and the campaign to focus on particular tests and treatments that may be unnecessary, that's a starting point. But we're in the middle of the largest transformation of how we organize and pay for, deliver healthcare that we're going to go through in our lifetime, I think. And there are three pieces to it, and they all interact. One is that we change how we deliver care. We're moving toward team care, toward, as we heard before, a partnership of physicians, nurse practitioners, pharmacists, psychologists working together in service of their patients. We're also moving toward a new kind of outreach where people do expect e-visits, 24/7 access, access in retail clinics in Walmart. That it's an explosion of types of delivery. But that has to be complemented by how we pay for care. Much of what is driving care is the fact that we pay for fee-for-service for doctor-patient FaceTime. We need to change so that we can pay for care that meets patients' needs more efficiently and saves the doctor time for those conversations that need the physician directly involved.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, I'd briefly mention another wonderful idea, Open Notes. Open Notes is the concept of all of us should have access to our doctor's notes, to what they actually write and say and what they think is going on. Nothing about me without me. And I think that's beginning to spread across the country. I think would really help to reduce some of the initial research on Open Notes suggests there's very significant reductions in use of services because there's more opportunities for consumers to learn what's going on.
She's crazy. Okay, yes, go ahead.
My name is Mark Bennett. I work with Health Insight. And, you know, when I first read the press release about Choosing Wisely when it came out a while ago, I was really excited. I thought this is an incredibly brave thing, as you said, and it's pushing the envelope in a way that physicians have never led in that way. And so I was really excited to be involved in it, and this is a great thing. But we're talking about that 30% waste, and when I add up the list of five per specialty society, if we get everything perfect on those, we aren't approaching 30% of savings in that way. And so I wondered if some of the panelists could comment on what's next. What do we need to do next in order to move towards that aim of making our system efficient and effective?
Not enough to start the conversation. What are the next steps, I guess? Dr. Cannon?
I think Dr. McGill kind of started it off. We do piecemeal health work right now. Things aren't coordinated very well. And there's a lot of change that needs to go forward. Unfortunately, it has to happen a little bit at a time. You can't, starting tomorrow, do half your visits on FaceTime, or we don't have the security in all this. But we need to work towards efficiency of care, the Choosing Wisely initiatives, getting patients access when they need it, ways to have a health visit not be just about checking your labs and how are they, but how are you sleeping? How much are you exercising? What are you eating? So it's a change in care and a change in finance.
That fits in with this next question. Will the Choosing Wisely campaign address the use of pharmaceutical and surgeries for diseases caused predominantly by lifestyle factors, i.e. diabetes, cardiovascular disease, etc.? Daniel?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
I don't think we've. I think we just started a conversation, and the lists that we put out are just a means to have this kind of conversation with the American public and with physicians. And I think it's a lot of little things that get done every day that are unnecessary. And we can have a list of 3,000 that would cover all those little things. It was just to make it a bit concrete so we could have these kind of conversations. Because 2 years ago, we were talking about rationing and killing grandma, and we couldn't have this kind of conversation. So this was an entryway to have rational conversations amongst the public, like we're having today, rather than, you know, very polarization of this issue. It's all about cost. It's not about cost. It's about better care. So I think we get, you know, I think we're going to get fatigued by lists. And frankly, it's now the time, once we have cultural change, attitudinal change, for people like Intermountain and University of Utah, which they are beginning to do, is implement these things. Let's see what happens. Let's see how care does improve. And let's see how not just the technical aspects of this, but the professional values and societal values come to play with this. So physicians don't think, and patients don't think, this is being done to them, and they're under control, and it's being done by the government, it's being the health plan. It's being done by us, the patients and the physicians in the room. And that's the point of this campaign. So I do think we get carried away with the lists, what's on the list, and I think there's a lot of great things on that list. Don't get me wrong, but there's things daily. And we're thinking about having more difficult conversations. Waste is the easiest thing, right? But we're thinking about how to have conversations about marginal benefit, two things that are equal, but one thing that is way more costly than the other. And we don't know how to have that conversation. We spent a year or two just thinking about how to frame this campaign. How to talk about it is very, very important. It gets to your motives, your purposes, your values. So we don't know how to have that conversation yet with the American public, because the American public, once you talk about, you know, unnecessary care, flips to you're just trying to take things away from me. Mm. And we have to be very careful that we don't get into that conversation. We need to take a high road that's really about quality. So we did have a society, radiation oncologist, and I'm probably going to insult you over here, that proton beam therapy machines for prostate cancer was not necessary. They are very expensive, and 10 times as expensive as the alternative, and very expensive to install. And this society came out and said, given that they're equal effectiveness, that is not a good thing to be doing. It's good in the circumstances of ocular eye and for children with cancer, but not prostate cancer, and that's what most of those are being done for.
I'm going to cut you off.